It's Friday, February 26th. Welcome to Market Foolery. I'm Chris Hill. Joining me in studio today, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, wait, it's Friday. Why is there an episode of Market Foolery? Well, as I said the other day, bonus episode this week. Joining me in studio, Jeff Fisher from Motley Fool Pro and Options, and David Gardner, co-founder of The Motley Fool, chief rule breaker, working on stock advisor rule breakers. And oh, yeah, he also hosts the Rule Breaker Investing podcast every week. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thank you, Chris. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, David.
Hey, Chris.
Great to see you both.
Thank you for responding to my invite. I like how you teed that up as though we just bumped into each other by the coffee machine. Hey, what are you doing
here? Well, we didn't really have to walk many feet to come over to the studio to talk about what is, I think, a very memorable time in our lives.
Definitely.
Certainly memorable. And as I say from time to time on Market Foolery, we don't talk about politics. That's not where we live here at The Motley Fool. Only every once in a great while does politics intercede with investing in a meaningful way to us. And yet, I think it's accurate to say that the person who is at the white-hot center of American politics right now is Donald Trump, which brings us to what I consider to be one of the great stories in Motley Fool history, and that is when the two of you met face-to-face with Donald Trump. I got to do a little bit of setup before I hand this over to you guys. Mm-hmm. Some of our listeners go way back to the beginning of The Fool. Some of our listeners just joined us in the last year or so. So let me get us all in the Wayback Machine. Let's go back to the mid-1990s. Fool.com has just launched, actually started on AOL in 1994. And David, you start running a real money portfolio called The Fool Portfolio with $50,000 of your own money. And revolutionary in a number of ways because it's hard, particularly for younger people. I've talked to younger people and talked about what investing was like in the 80s and 90s, and they look at me like I'm insane. But back then, the internet is really just getting started, and full-service brokerages are basically charging whatever fees that they want. And so you come along, you launch the Fool Portfolio, which announces trades ahead of time, something Wall Street was not doing at the time. Comparing your results to the S&P 500, also not commonly done, and including fees in the returns, definitely not done back in the day on Wall Street. And so you're managing, you're writing up different stock reports, investing in these stocks, sharing the results, and over a couple of years, you changed the name of the portfolio from the Fool Portfolio to the Rule Breaker Portfolio. And anyone familiar with your style of investing knows why you did that. And then April 30th, 1997, the Rule Breaker Portfolio, which Jeff, you start helping David manage along the way, comes out with its latest recommendation. And it is not a buy. It is a short. And it is not just any short. It is a short of Trump Hotels and Casino Resorts, which was publicly traded at the time on the day for $8.50 a share.
Stock ticker T or DJT.
That's right. For the three initials of the founder's name, Donald J. Trump.
Not always a great buy indicator when someone says, you know what a great ticker would be?
Well,
my initials.
He's putting his name and his reputation on the line.
Let's start with the short. Whose idea was it in the first place?
I don't think that I remember necessarily. I know one thing. Jeff and I kind of co-developed an approach to shorting that we were calling buzzard bait shorts, and I think it conformed.
We were screening for companies with a lot of debt at high interest rates that resulted in very high interest payments that did not look sustainable, and Trump floated to the top of the list.
Yeah, there are a couple more traits there in the buzzard bait short approach that we have that we still like. We just don't short as much anymore at The Fool, but you do some, though, Jeff. Maybe you still do this.
We are short Caesars Entertainment right now in Pro, which is very much in the same vein as Trump back in the day.
Okay, good. So a couple more things we were looking for, Chris, is we were looking for stocks that had already fallen a ton under the assumption that they're going to keep going, right? So we were already – I'm going to make this up. You can check the math. But DJT, ticker symbol DJT, had already fallen a long way to get to 8.5. And then the other thing we're looking for are companies that are losing money. So they're not only do they have a ton of debt, but they're losing money, so you can't really see where they're going to be paying their debt off, and their stock is well done.
We also loved that this business model literally shakes the pockets clean of its customers if it does its job right.
Yeah, and you're saying love in a sarcastic sarcasm, of yes. course, being the wit of fools, as I'm sure we all know. It's kind of a sad business. It's one yes. that traditionally, at least for services that I'm still doing what we did back in the day. We started picking stocks right out front of America on August 4th, 1994, Chris, and I was going to say things really haven't changed that much.
Right.
Announcing our trades ahead of time, here we are 23 years later. But
let me just stop you for one second, yeah. because back while, you know, at this point in time in Fool history, and I mentioned this right before we started taping, yes, that approach has not changed. And there has been greater transparency when it comes to investing over the last 20 years. But at the time, I was heading up the Motley Fool's media relations efforts. And I can tell you from multiple conversations I had with reporters and editors that some of them were flat out dumbfounded by this approach. And I can't count the number of times I was talking to a reporter and they would look at the website and say, "This, you know, and so what is this? What is this portfolio? I don't get it. How does this work?" And I'm like, "Well, David announces the trades ahead of time. Well, why would he do that?" "Well, we actually believe that there should be greater transparency on Wall Street." Okay. So what's the catch? What's the catch? Like, how do you make up the money? It's like, I don't know how to make you understand. I'm trying really hard. We're literally laying all our cards on the table.
Especially when you announce a short to the public, this is just the general public, and they pile into the short, and then we get to short afterwards at a lower price still. So it was true of many buys, too. We recommended Starbucks in 97, I believe, Amazon right when it came public, Amgen very early. David, that was another
yeah,
one.
Yeah, so the stocks would, because it was a free site, so anybody could come and see what we were doing, and the stocks would trade up the next day, and we would buy a few days after that. But I think, because I know everybody listening to this podcast knows that we're long-term in our orientation, it doesn't really bother us that much if a stock pops or goes against us. Often those are very temporary anyway, and who really remembers 3 years later?
We do.
Well, for this story, we remember about 16 and a half years later.
Yeah. April 30th, 1997, you publicly announced the short of Trump Hotels and Casino Resorts. Let's fast forward 2 years, specifically August 3rd, 1999. David, you get to your desk. There's a voicemail message from Nicholas, is it Ribas?
Ribas.
Nicholas Ribas, CEO of Trump Hotels and Casino Resorts. What did he say?
He said he was interested in meeting with us. He said, "Mr. Trump, and we're aware of our short, and we're very influential, and they'd like to have an opportunity just to talk. They could come down to Alexandria, or we could go up there and discuss the short of Donald's company."
And I would say, very smartly, you said, "Oh, no, don't come here. We want to come to you."
I mean, the opportunity to go up to New York City, go to Trump Towers, and meet with the Donald in his office was tempting enough that we took it.
So September, you head up, the two of you. Dale Wetlaufer, one of our early analysts at The Fool, and there was someone else. There was an intern?
Yeah, Charity.
Charity was her name.
Yeah, Charity.
Probably still is her name.
Who was a college intern, and I wanted, you know, it was an opportunity. We had 40 interns that summer. And so she was working closely with me and our service, so I wanted her to have that experience. What I didn't know was that Charity had not only never been to New York City, she had never been on an airplane.
Wow.
And so there we were on an airplane to New York City, landing and going directly to the 26th floor of Trump Towers to meet with Donald Trump. So Charity, and I think you're down in North Carolina somewhere these days. We're all 16 years older or so, but I hope you still remember that hour.
What do you remember, Jeff, about the flight up? Because if it were me, I think I would be a combination of excited and just slightly nervous.
Well, to start right as we are kind of rolling down the runway, David leans over to Charity and says, "You know, Charity, most airline accidents happen in the first 60 seconds."
Oh, nice.
Before takeoff.
Which is accurate, by
it's
the way.
Accurate.
I'd forgotten that I said that to her, but I'm glad that you remember that,
Jeff. Yeah, we teased David that he could have waited 60 seconds and then told her that. But we made it. And we landed in New York, obviously, and hopped into a taxi to Trump Tower. And the funny thing was, a little aside, was the taxi driver said he had met Mr. Trump many times, and I think Frank Sinatra and all these other people. He had story after story that just made the world seem very small. So to Charity, who had never been to New York before, it must have seemed, maybe took a little of the shine off, like, oh, well, it's New York. I'll see Tom Cruise around the corner, something like that. But the flight up, we compared notes on what we had written about Trump the last couple of years, and David had developed a habit of of calling Trump Tiny. That was his nickname Tiny? For Trump.
We had daily reports. I mean, so you could come to our website and see a daily report of how our portfolio was doing each day. So we had a lot of ample opportunity over a couple of years to talk about each of the dozen or so stocks that were in our portfolio. And we thought it was funny. I think it starts with me. I thought it was funny.
At that point, it was a penny stock.
Well, it was more,
when it gets below five.
It was more that Mr. Trump's reputation, as we understood it coming in through the 80s and 90s, was that he was fairly egotistical. And so we thought that it was funny that instead of calling him, you know, he's so big, and everyone's always talking about how big Donald Trump is, we just start calling him Tiny. And because the company that he was running wasn't doing very well, as Jeff points out, it was getting smaller and smaller. It seemed like the right term at
the time. Yeah, the market cap was shrinking. Yeah, yeah. So that was David's, you know, affectionate nickname for Donald.
I will say I'm not necessarily proud of that. I don't think I leveled up the public discourse.
You were in your 20s. I mean,
we were having fun.
Taking chances.
Yeah. Wet behind the ears.
Being foolish.
So you get there, you get up to the 26th floor. What was it like? What was his office like? And what is the initial 60 seconds in the room with Donald Trump like?
The first thing that I think about is that Nicholas Rivers met us right out front, and he said, Donald, would like to see you, brought us right in. And Trump's office at the time was two very large rooms, so the equivalent of two conference rooms stacked together, and he has a massive desk at the back of one of those rooms. And I remember that there was he had a framed thing of dollar bills on his desk, which was kind of a funny sight. He had, understandably, a lot of people like him do this. A lot of pictures of himself with notaries up on the walls, and he was, you know, he graciously welcomed us and said hello in an affable way to Jeff and me and Dale and Charity.
Exactly, they offered us a Coca-Cola or
styrofoam cup,
other beverage in a styrofoam cup. Of course, it was a corner office, glass all around. And yeah, as David said, the one main wall was covered with magazine covers and photographs of Donald. And one thing I couldn't help but notice as we walked into, the tower is very gilded, as you would expect. It's not unlike Apprentice, if you've seen that show in the past. He really lives in that sort of gilded environment. And it seemed like the company hired, in large part, based on looks. Like, and I'll just leave it at that.
You're looking at the other employees and thinking, wow, there's a lot of really good-looking people here. So, and David, you wrote up a report, and we'll get to that in a moment. But one of the things, when I was rereading that, you gave credit to Trump for inviting you up there in the first place. Like, for whatever else we're going to say about Donald Trump, there are plenty of people on Wall Street who see that someone's shorting my stock, someone's taking shots at me, I'm just going to ignore them. For whatever reason, and maybe it was 100% pure ego, Donald Trump said, no, I'm gonna invite these people up here, try and talk them out of this.
I do. I give credit to Trump along a number of different dimensions. Here's one of them, though. Chris, you're right. That was a time where even public companies were not necessarily opening up their quarterly conference calls to shareholders to listen to the CEO answer Wall Street questions. And right, the something we all take for granted today, they're all taped replay, you can watch them live. Starbucks back in the day was not opening up its quarterly conference calls to be listened to, which caused us to mount a write-in campaign from our radio show at the time, and happy to say Starbucks listened and changed. But that was the environment in 1999 that we were working in. And so the notion that the CEO of this company, who's we're short his company, invites us to come and talk with him, I thought was pretty impressive.
Ivanka Trump, who anyone who's following American politics, Donald Trump's daughter, she's with him on the campaign trail, a grown woman now. At the time, 18 years old. Was she really the one who flagged this for her dad? Because I can't imagine Donald Trump back in the 90s is clicking around the internet going to fool.com.
That's what he told us, and David can probably retell exactly how Donald shared this.
Yeah, well, he said, Ivanka reads what you guys write. So, you know, we get these other nice things said about us on Wall Street, but then she only listens to you guys. So she came to me and said, Daddy, the fools say that you have a crummy company. So that's why I had you in, he said.
You know what? I believe that. I mean, we all have kids. It's, you know, you can say, well, I'm leaving my work at my workplace. But once one of your kids walks up to you and starts talking to you about your job, then it becomes real in a whole different dimension.
Yeah, he let off with saying, now you may wonder why I had you in. I give you credit. You guys are very influential. You can hear Trump saying this. This is straight from his lips. You guys are very influential. You know my daughter, Ivanka? And it went from there.
I'm assuming at some point after the pleasantries, after the would you like a beverage and please sit and be comfortable and telling how you're up there in the first place, at some point, Jeff, it has to get down to the business, and he's got to be talking to you guys about, look, this is how we're going to win.
It did. If I could summarize it, I would say Donald and Nicholas Ribas did 70 to 75% of the talking. When we would speak, they would politely listen, but I don't know that it would be contemplated much what we said, except to respond back what they already believed to be true. Dale was especially pointed in his critiques of the company's financials, of the debt load, of the interest, which was easy to point out as a major Achilles heel. And Donald did admit some mistakes. He admitted mistakes right off the bat, but he'd always come back around to his argument, as you would expect, that the company will be strong and we'll get through this and everything will be fine. And they had some arguments that were a little more emotional in regards to the marina and the water view that they had and the properties they owned.
Because at the time, this was a business. If you get in a time machine and you're bullish on this stock, I'm assuming a lot of it has to do with Atlantic City. He's got the property in Atlantic City, which leads to the headline of your article, the classic quote from Trump, which is maybe the largest brick in his bull case wall. That's a terrible analogy, but basically, like, one of his big beliefs is because of where the property is located.
I own the water.
I own the water.
Yeah. And that's what we taught. In fact, if you want to read our recounting, you just Google the phrase, I own the water,
I'll tweet
Trump.
I'll tweet this out on the Market Foolery.
It's a great article David wrote in 99. Yep. It's a great, it's really fun.
It was
fun.
Just days after. But yeah, I mean, here was what was at the heart of this short decision. So Donald Trump, the private real estate man, had sold to Donald Trump's public company, Trump Marina. And you as a public company shareholder, you're buying from the CEO, from his private company, a property. You are borrowing a huge amount of money through your public company as a shareholder of this company. They have to rack up $2 billion of debt about in order to make these kinds of purchases. And you can see who they're paying, right? They're paying Trump's private real estate company. So they're basically borrowing a massive amount to overpay for a property that saddles the public company with an asset that it can't really ever pay for and brings it to the teetering edge of bankruptcy. And that was our short. That was our reasoning at the time. He's remunerated his private company by selling for an unrealistic price a property, and it was Trump Marina. It was the water. I mean, to Trump's credit, he really developed Atlantic City. I'm not sure it's worked out too great 20 years later, but at the time, he borrowed a huge amount of money to even make it possible to kind of renew and reinvigorate Atlantic City. His arch rival at the time probably still is in some ways, although things have shifted some in his life, was Steve Wynn. And Steve Wynn was kind of the foil to Trump. Wynn had an admired company, Mirage Resorts. Trump's company at the time, we were noting, was actually last on the list of America's most admired companies from one significant business magazine survey. So Wynn was starting to make incursions into Atlantic City, and that was extremely threatening to Trump. And so he really didn't like Steve Wynn. I bet he still really doesn't like Steve Wynn.
When the hour was up, what went through your mind? Did you think, oh God, we survived this? Because one of the things you touched on was, on your way up there, David, you're thinking, you know what, 20% chance something really bad happens. So when the hour is up, do you think to yourself, that went as well as I had hoped, that went better than I had hoped, I wish I had another hour, or are you thinking, God, get me out of here now?
I thought it was an appropriate amount of time. We had an opportunity to talk some about his business. We had that memorable experience for us four. Maybe not for Donald. I don't know if he'll remember. He probably doesn't want to remember this because things for the company didn't end up too well. We closed the short. It was my call after the meeting. I decided, based on what he was saying, stuff like, you guys don't know that debt that looks so devastating for my public company, we're going to be renegotiating that, getting a much better deal. You guys don't know that yet, but I like you guys. So I'm not inside information, but I'm telling you ahead of time, we're working at that. And so you guys need to know some stuff's coming. You probably want to close that short. And at the time, I felt like with the stock already having gone from 8.5 down to 5, we had made more than 40% of our money during a time when the S&P 500 had gone up over 60% those couple of years. So it was a tremendous investment. So I felt comfortable declaring victory and saying, let's see going forward, since he's given us his word about this and that this company is going to work out, despite him saying, you know, he'd made a lot of mistakes with the company, which he was the first to admit, although in his own way, whenever he actually admitted a mistake, I noticed that he would then go on to explain why it wasn't really a mistake. But so we kind of closed it out. And, you know, I think, Chris, that hour is something that we'll always treasure. It was a long time ago, but I'm not sure that much has changed.
Yeah, I was surprised by how true to his media persona he was in person. There didn't seem to be an act. There just was the Donald, and that was what you got.
So the guy who is campaigning for president right now, maybe not necessarily at a public rally, but when he's sitting down doing an interview on television, that's the guy in his private office.
I think so. And in a way, he's become more intense from what little I've seen of him in the current day. Back then, when we met him, he was 53. Right now, he's 69. I think he's at the peak of, or about to be, he hopes, of what he can accomplish. And so he's very fiery, clearly. So I think he is the guy we met in 99, but even amped up a little bit more. He's had more business success since then. His own real estate companies, not so much in the casinos, but
yeah, it turns out we should have left that short in because it did expire bankrupt a few years later.
It did. And they fired Nicholas Ribas, the CEO, was let go. And then soon after, we noticed in the annual report online that Ribas, in a kind of Stalin-esque fashion, was taken out of the photo. Just completely
they photoshopped him out.
Wow.
The ultimate indignity.
You can still see his shoulder. So it's a little rewriting of history, if you could.
As he let us out, and Nick Ribas was a very nice guy. I would say he was the analogy I think I made, as we talked about this in front of our employees at the time, just privately, is I think I was saying, if Donald is the Wicked Witch of the West, then Nicholas Ribas is a flying monkey. I do remember Ribas saying, as he said goodbye to us, you know, I've always said that the greatest asset any business can have is Donald J. Trump. And now you have met him, and so now you can agree with me. So, I mean, Ribas was probably in a difficult position overall. The company was not in good shape. But it was a very affable guy. And again, very mixed feelings about this. We have no political point to make. I appreciate how you open this, Chris, because I stay far out of politics. But the experience that we had was I think telling, and one that mixes foolish humor and a lot of mixed feelings, like a CEO and a chairman who would invite us in when we're short their company is very impressive. That they told us that the company was going to be okay, and then it was still bankrupt a few years later, not so impressive. But, you know, I think just I'm glad we had this opportunity to tell the story because it does feel relevant here 16 years later. But it's also just a wonderful walk down memory lane, and I love Jeff's thoughtful summations, and Jeff's memory is much better than mine when he's talking about the experience. So thanks a lot for having us on.
Yeah, thank you. I will say, in the very end, Trump said, call me anytime. If you have any questions, call me anytime, and maybe we should take him up on that offer now. I mean, it's any time.
I remember he pointed at his phone. He said, call me.
Yep.
I'll answer your questions.
So, hey, he's open to disagreement.
Thanks for being here, guys.
Thank you.
As always, people on the program may have interest in the stocks they talk about, and The Motley Fool may have formal recommendations for or against. So don't buy or sell stocks based solely on what you hear. That's going to do it for this edition of Market Foolery. The show is mixed by Dan Boyd. I'm Chris Hill. Thanks for listening. We'll see you on Monday.
But no one understands him but his woman.